In today's fast-changing digital world, proving your company's trustworthy isn't just important for growth, it's essential. That's why Vanta is here. Vanta helps companies of all sizes get compliant fast and stay that way with their proprietary AI, automation, and continuous monitoring. So whether you're a startup tackling your first SOC 2 or ISO 27001 or an enterprise managing vendor risk, Vanta's trust management platform makes it quicker, easier, and more scalable. It even helps you complete security questionnaires up to 5 times faster, so you can close bigger deals sooner. And the impact? According to a recent IDC study, Vanta customers cut over $500,000 a year in costs and boost productivity by 3 times. Establishing trust isn't optional. Vanta makes it automatic. Visit vanta.com/go to sign up for a free demo today. That's vanta.com/go.
Hey everyone, J.J. Cooper, Jeff Ponce, another Baseball America Prospect podcast. We apologize, we missed last week. We were traveling. Jeff was traveling from back from the All-Star Game. I was traveling back from the All-Star Game. I'll start with kind of like my mea culpa here, you know, a little story to kind of set the scene, which is my, I'm from Georgia originally. So this was kind of a chance to go home, going back to Georgia for the All-Star Game. I have covered Braves games at Fulton County Stadium, Turner Field, and Truist Park. So this is 3 different parks. I'm old. But so plan was cover the All-Star Game weekend, cover the All-Star Game, and then head down to Perry, Georgia, which is where I'm from, and see my folks, see my brother and sister-in-law and all that. So I'm at the All-Star Game and having a very good time. I love being at the All-Star Game. But I'm also, as I just mentioned, old. So as much as I do not like leaving games early, I was thinking this through, and I'm like, I've got a 2.5 hour, depending on traffic, drive after this game. So I kind of set my time at like, okay, if we're getting to the 9th inning by 11, maybe I'll kind of just stick it out. Like, by the way, I wasn't writing. I had written stuff earlier in the day, but like I was enjoying this game as someone who loves baseball at this point. So I don't want to make it sound like, you know, that I was on deadline to write an All-Star Gamer. We don't write an All-Star Gamer. But so I'm sitting there and I'm like, okay, if that's the plan. And the first innings kind of fly by. And then I'm thinking, okay. And then I kind of forgot about the fact that it's an All-Star game. So we had some really cool moments. You know, they always do the Stand Up for Cancer, and that was an extra 5 minutes there. But then we did that amazing, they did that amazing honoring of Henry Aaron's 715th homer with the environmental projection where they projected it onto the field. We had a firework, all that. And that was awesome. But that meant that was another about, I'd say, 8 minutes between, you know, game action and all. So at 11 o'clock, I realized like, oh, we're still in the eighth. And so it's something I very rarely do. I bailed because I was like, if I wait till the end of this game, I'm going to walk out with the crowd. I've got a mile walk to my car. I'm going to get stuck in traffic. I'm not going to get to my folks till 3:30 in the morning. And I'm old. 3:30 is not something 20 something JJ could handle that. So I get in the car. It's 6:04, I think, at this point. And I'm listening to the game and all, and yeah, tie game. So I get text, congratulations, JJ, you're witnessing history. And so I'm listening on this, you know, Android Auto and everything. I'm texting back. I'm going, I'm not, I'm stuck in traffic on the south side of Atlanta at this point. So yes, I have seen a home run swing off to win an All-Star game, but it'll have to stick with, I saw it in the Midwest League back when minor league teams had All-Star games. I saw that in 2019. Chris Betts hit, led the North or the South to a All-Star game win by winning the home run derby. But so, yeah, I did not see that in person, but man, it was fun to be there for all of the futures game, draft, everything that we got to see, wasn't it, Jeff?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. I think you should have gotten a hotel.
I did think about that. That would have been what would have happened is I would have gotten a hotel.
But I told my parents, an hour outside of Atlanta and gotten a hotel anywhere you possibly could have.
That if I had known that there was going to be a swing off, I 100% would have done that. But it was the eighth, and I'm like, if I miss an inning, it was 6:04 at the time. Yes. In hindsight, that's what I should have done. But I did get down there by 1:30. And so like I was still, you know, functional and drivable at that point.
Yeah.
But yeah. There is a regret. I have regrets.
Well, maybe I'll put it this way. Maybe it's a butterfly effect kind of thing where had you not left, perhaps the game never gets.
Right. Maybe we just had a rander
swing off. So maybe you had to sacrifice for the greater good.
Well, it was good. Whatever it was, I was listening to it when it happened. And that was very dramatic. And
it was great.
Way better than Bud Selig holding up his, you know, palms up raised. Like, what are we going to do? Way better than that. So,
yeah. I'm not old. I'm old, but not as old as JJ.
Not me old.
I haven't covered, games at three different stadiums for my local team. They've only had one stadium for like the last 100 years. So that might be a big part of it. But I remember that 2002 All-Star game. I was with my friends in college. We were playing wiffle ball outside before the game and kind of like in between innings at times. We had this running wiffle ball game. It was like 10 of us. All together, we were like 20 years old, watching that game. And I can remember we wanted to riot after that game ended because we were all like, what the heck is going on here? We have a tie in the All-Star game. And it was a big deal. And it's one of the reasons that I think the next year, if you remember, was kind of goofy. They had, you know, the home field advantage for
this time it counts
series. This time it counts was their marketing campaign, and that was also kind of laughable. A lot of questionable decisions by MLB at that point in time. But for me, I thought this was great. I think it's the right way to end an All-Star game. It was exciting. It got people talking, and you know, you don't want to put pitchers out there unless they have the portable traject machine. They can go out there and each team gets to program in one guy from history or something. I really don't see any reason to not do a swing off because you can't use pitchers this way.
You have heard me. That's basically something I've been saying for years is I don't know when it's happening, but at some point, whether it's going to be the Arizona Fall League or summer college leagues that do it first, we are going to get to the robot pitcher because there's going to be a point at which there's going to be some level that the hitters are going to hit, but we've run out of pitching. And that is kind of a cool feature. It's like, hey, we're going to do the best approximation of Sandy Koufax for this game, or Walter Johnson is on the mound, you know, or whatever. That would be kind of a cool way. You get to pick Nolan Ryan, you know, is going to pitch Nolan Ryan can pitch for the American League or the National League, kind of choose your, the American League gets 70s Nolan Ryan and the National League gets 80s Astros Nolan Ryan or whatever.
You got to pick one. You got to pick one year, like one version of it. So it's like 87 Nolan Ryan or, you know, 76 Nolan Ryan. You get to, you know, pick one year.
But so we're not, that's not what we're going to spend our time talking about today. The trade deadline is here. The trade deadline is right around the corner. And with that being the case, we're going to talk all about the trade deadline today. We're going to look at players, teams, going to ask some questions. Well, even if we got at least one trade proposal that a reader kind of submitted that will. And by the way, when we get to that, I will give credit. So often, I will just start with this little preamble. So often when you see trade proposals from fans, it can best be described as, I would love to see my team do this. And the end result is we add this great player from this other team and trade away all these prospects who I would be perfectly happy to trade away. This proposal actually at least kind of leaves a little bit of a mark for both teams. And I think that's, again, that's a key thing that is very true about when you are talking about, not talking about, when you're talking about trading for that reliever who's going to pitch the six for you, that does not leave a mark. When you talk about, hey, we're adding a bench bat, doesn't leave a mark. But if you add a 3+ war player, even if it's a rental, it should leave a mark on the team that is acquiring said player. But Jeff, kind of as we get ready to dive in, I'll start with this question. We talked about this a little bit on the Hot Sheet show on Monday, but last year we had 0 top 100 prospects traded, which is unusual. Usually we see at least a few. I would say, though, although that is a steadily diminishing number, it was up to 9, you know, I think in back 10 years ago, I would be shocked to see us get to 9 again anytime soon. But do you think there will be top 100 prospects traded? And if so, kind of what's your over under on how many will be traded?
Yeah. I do think that we'll see some top 100 prospects traded. I think part of it in terms of how this all sets up is, number one, we have a lot of teams that are currently really competitive, you know, in the playoff picture, in that championship window, that have pretty good farm systems. And I think that's a big part of it. And having good players from the top of the system to trade, but also sort of those secondary and like fiduciary pieces that often get, you know, put into some of these bigger deals if big names are going to move. So, you know, I think my over under number probably, because I like to do the tricky part of it, is 2.5, because it forces you to kind of think under or over. I think 2.5 to 3 is kind of where my head's at, because I could see it being 2. I could see it being 3. I do think 4 or 5 would probably be a lot. Now, there's always this element of top 100 prospects define a top 100 prospect. Well, for us, it's anybody that's on the BA list. For the general consensus, that can vary, especially, and, you know, parts 65, as we say, to
good point
50. There's a variation there. Like,
good, very good point.
Yeah.
Very good point that
Ramirez was a top 100 guy last year.
If you're talking about that someone is in the top 100 discussion, that to me, like, okay, yes, we're a man has to have a code. You know, we're going to stick with, you know, the top 100. That's our top 100 that we update all the time. But yeah, if you said, I'm just trying to think of someone who's right off the periphery of our top 100 right now. You know, if someone like that, if someone who we're like, yeah, we've been talking about that player on the top 100, they haven't made it yet, and they get traded, there's very little difference between that player and someone who's 75th on this list. Okay, but I will ask one more on that before we kind of really roll up our sleeves on this, which is, but there's a very big difference between that, as we always say, and a top 25 prospect. And that's something that we have very rarely seen get traded in recent years. Do you think there will be a top 25-ish? Again, I'm not going to hold you to it. If our 27th prospect gets traded, that counts. But a top 25, top 30-ish prospect, the elite prospects in the game, do you think any of those will be traded?
I don't. And especially when we put that in the context of like current top 25 to top 30, I think the best chance for like a big hit for a team is going to be somebody that's top 100 that's probably outside of that range. We can go back to the Soto trade, which I think is kind of the gold standard. When we look at big trades for a big name, pieces moving on both ends, a little bit of pain for both teams, though it obviously made more sense for the Nationals, I think, in their long-term picture. We know what the Padres were trying to do, and, you know, credit to them for that. But James Wood, like somebody like that, who I think...
DJ Abrams.
Maybe wasn't on the top 100 at that point. Back end of the top
100? No, he was number 61.
There we go. So it's like just outside that top sort of 30 range. But I think he was trending to the top 30. And if you were really in on upside in terms of how you rank out your list, you might have had Wood in there. So I think it's going to be more somebody like that than it's going to be a big, big name. You know, the Padres are a contending team. I don't think DeVries is going to get moved. Of course, Anthony and Meyer are still technically prospects for at least a couple more days while we're recording this. If the Red Sox swing a big trade, I don't think either of those guys are going to get moved. So, you know, Jordan Lawler, another guy that probably isn't going to get, you know, Suarez is going to get moved. We talked about that in the hot sheet show yesterday. I think there's even more examples. The Brewers are in first place right now, you know, are one of the best teams in baseball. I don't think they're going to move Mate or a Pena or a Mizzy Orowski, right? There's maybe some other players in that range that they can.
Or a Cooper Pratt or you know, a Cuero.
We'll
get there.
Yeah, but I think there's a lot of teams like that where they have kind of a primary top prospect and then these secondary guys. I think some of those secondary guys could get moved for sure.
We're going to dive all into it. We're going to get into team by team, look at a lot of different teams. This one, buckle in. We may be here for a little while today on the Prospect Podcast, and we'll be right back. Talk more about this right after this quick break.
Time for a quickie break. Todd Father and I are going to tell you about Huel, but it's mostly going to be Todd Father because I'm going to take a sip.
Well, we're talking about Huel, 27 vitamins and minerals. It's a complete meal. Let's listen. We all have busy schedules. As Scott's sipping it down, it looks delicious. It tastes delicious. When we're on the run, we need something to eat quick. And guess what? Huel is there. All different flavors. Scotty loves them. I love them. And I love how variety packed it is. And we can eat them any time of the day.
That's right. Yeah, check out the website. There's bars. There are so many different flavors. I love the black edition. Chocolate, 35 grams of protein. There's strawberry shortcake, coffee caramel, cookies and cream. I can go on. And you get yourself 15% off if you're a new customer using the code FOUL at Huel.com/FOUL. Please see our description for the terms and conditions. Skip the stress, not the nutrition. Try Huel today for complete nutrition with the code FOUL at Huel.com/FOUL.
And we're back. So, Jeff, before we get in, I'm going to throw out this trade proposal that we got from the Duke on Twitter, on X, I guess I should say. But trade proposal. Alfredo Duno, Chase Petty, and Leo Balcazar for Jaren Duran. Red Sox and Reds trade here. We have seen speculation that the Red Sox could trade Jaren Duran, even though the Red Sox also, I feel like, are one of those teams that is kind of in it at the same time. But I said, this is at least, we'll just evaluate this trade. I'll kick it to you first. But I'll kick it to you saying, the thing I like about this at least is, in Alfredo Duno and Chase Petty, you're Alfredo Duno especially, you're leaving a mark here. I don't think it's enough personally, but what's your impression also?
Yeah, I don't think this is quite enough probably. Petty's a good prospect player, you know, probably a quick to the rotation piece, a guy that might be in the mix there.
I struggled in the majors in very brief exposure so far.
Yeah, and they've had guys like Richard Fitz and then Hunter Dobbins who have had some success in sort of those back-end roles or fill-in roles for them this season so far. So I don't know that it necessarily fits a need unless they feel there's something within Petty's arsenal that the Reds haven't unlocked, that they feel they can unlock. They need catching in the system. Duno is a good piece. I don't know that he's enough to swing this trade because Duran still has cost-controlled years remaining. I think he has control for maybe another 2 or 3 years. So there's a lot of value in that, and I think the bounty is going to be way more than something like this. And I do think that the Red Sox would be looking for maybe a young major league piece that has some redundancy with the team that they're trading with. Like, that's ideal, where it's like, this is a really good player who might start for the Red Sox, but we don't have the opportunity to get him into the rotation or into the lineup right now. It's not going to be an outfielder either. So,
right. I would say that, like, if you said that this trade's going to happen, it would be more like, and again, this isn't going to happen, but like, I don't think either for the Reds, but it would be like saying, we're going to take one of your young, cost-controlled starters who's having big league success. I don't think that Andrew Abbott for Jaren Duran is a deal that you're going to see, but that's the kind of thing where you're talking about where you could say on both teams, hey, you know, the Reds have some starting pitching redundancy and the Red Sox need outfielders and the Red Sox need, another starter who's going to pitch playoff games, not just a starter who you add to your, that would maybe be something. But again, I don't think that that's a trade that's going to happen. I do think though, if I was the Reds, I'm absolutely looking and seeing if there are outfielders out there, because that is one of the positions I would say that is generally easiest to find. And the Reds could use some help there. But okay, so we're going to dive in. And I'll start with the very open-ended question, which is, okay, let's start with, the trade deadline is where it is, right? We're not going to get into should it be moved back. I would fully approve an August 15th type deadline or something like that. But the trade deadline is what it is. There's a lot of teams, I would say, that are in kind of halfway, kind of maybe listening on both sides type teams, because are you really in? Are you going to be able to make that run? But then you look at the Tigers last year, who did make that run, and it kind of really set the stage for them to take another step further, forward this year. So, okay, there's a balance to be struck here. What is a team that you want to start with as far as, hey, this is a team that we kind of feel comfortable we can say is going to make moves. And here's why this could make some fits.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting because there's so many different directions that you could potentially go with this, right? I think the Cubs are really interesting right now because they're a bigger market team. They're probably more willing to take on salary than some other teams are. They're very much in win now mode because they have a big question mark at the end of the year with Kyle Tucker re-signing or not. So you made some trades that I don't think necessarily mortgage the future, but you traded away a really good player in Cam Smith, right? Who's starting games, was right up to the big leagues. Whether he did that for you or not, either way was going to be a big trade asset and a cost-controlled, you know, everyday player for them. You make the trade 100 times out of 100. But that said, they have a lot of close to the majors players who are now blocked. They have the ability to have sort of a backup plan for Kyle Tucker in AAA and still trade away multiple players on that AAA team. They're in a good spot. And I think a lot of these guys, some of them are top 100 prospects. Some of them kind of fall into that cushion just outside of the top 100, maybe have been on before and off, a guy like Kevin Alcantara, or even James Triantos, who's had not such a great season. Jonathan Long is another one like that. Maybe they dip into some of their ready-made pitching. Will Sanders has had kind of a breakout year. He's in AAA. He might be able to give a second division team innings right now in the major leagues. And if they really wanted to get wild, I think Jackson Wiggins is potentially a top 100 prospect and a guy who's had a massive breakout this year, big stuff, showing starter traits, throwing a lot more strikes than he ever has, even in his amateur career. So they got a lot of pieces to trade from. And I think the Brewers are really interesting. I think you look at the Brewers as a smaller market team that is very good at identifying and developing players. They have a very deep farm system, maybe as talented and as deep as any team in baseball. And the question with them is they only have maybe so much money that they can take on, but they have a lineup that I think is really easily improved with a couple of sort of rental, you know, hitters and guys that might be a little cheaper because they kind of need power. Maybe a great fit for as a trade partner with the Orioles, who have a couple of power bats that they could potentially trade, and a guy like Ryan O'Hearn, Ryan Mountcastle, and others.
I want to jump in. You mentioned the Cubs there, and I want to kind of break that down a little bit further here. I do think that the Cubs, obviously, they're looking for pitching. I would say that lineup-wise, it's hard to look at a whole lot of lineups that are better than theirs. But I will say with that, the Dodgers also, as they always are, going to be looking for pitching. And I wanted to pose this question for you. If you need an outfielder, if you said, okay, obviously you take the best package that you can get and teams can piece that together. But if I need an outfielder, if I want to build a prospect package based around outfielders, do I want the Dodgers package, which again, it wouldn't be all of, but it would be some form of Zahir Hope, Josue DePaula, Mike Sirota, all top 100 prospects for us, or the Cubs package. You've got Owen Casey, like you said, you got Alcantara. But I don't think, like, if it comes down to again, obviously you can mix and match, but I don't think the Cubs have as much ammunition there if, and again, it's a big if, but I think, like, as we say most years, it feels like, but with the Dodgers, if the two teams were competing for the same pitcher, I feel like the Dodgers kind of can win that battle if they wanted to.
Probably. And I guess it just comes down to where the trading team is at, you know, sort of in their competitive window, like probably outside of it, of course, because they're selling off. But is it like a year away from a step forward? Is it many years away from a step forward? I'll pose it like this. I don't think Mitch Keller would fetch prospects of this ilk, frankly. But if you're the Pirates and you're moving Mitch Keller, wouldn't it make more sense for where you're at and where your strengths are at with pitching and what that rotation is going to look like for the next several years? Wouldn't it make more sense to go after a Casey or someone like that? Of course, it's in division, so this is probably an unlikely trade. But I'm just saying that style of player, somebody who is major league ready. Like, I think on probably more than half the teams in the league, he's already started games and might have graduated from prospect status, kind of. And he's been hitting, and he's a good defender. He's a day one starter, I think, for whatever team acquires him. If it was the Pirates, I think he starts day one and might be one of the more exciting bats in the middle of that lineup right away. You know, I do think that in most cases, the Dodgers have the firepower. Where I think it really lies, even on a player-by-player basis there, if you eliminate the top piece, those second, third pieces and the types of players that the Dodgers can send because of how deep that system is and how talented it is and how good they are in terms of the identification and acquisition phases of player or team building. I think the Dodgers probably can get a deal done with anybody for just about any player. And they have major league pieces that they can trade and kind of like, you know, Dalton Rushing, though he's been in the big leagues for a long time, hasn't played a whole lot. And I think if the right deal, the right player was out there, I don't think he's untouchable at this point.
I feel like Alex Freeland's value is dipping. But at the same time, Alex Freeland, if he was traded again to this hypothetical deal to the Pirates, would be better than, I mean, that would be one of the better young building blocks that the Pirates would have. I just think, right. I guess the other point I would say with this, with the Cubs, and again, we don't know, like, if they're willing to include Moises Ballesteros in a deal, I would say that that would make things more interesting. But I do think that they kind of have a number of these prospects who are blocked, but at the same time, I don't know. They have value. I don't want to make it sound like they're not going to have value, but I just don't think that they're the first piece in a key trade. I think Casey fits that. I think Ballesteros fits that. I might end the list there, is I guess what I'm saying. Would you agree or disagree?
Yeah, I think that's probably
right. And the reason I brought up the Dodgers is whereas I think that depending on the team that they're talking to, I think Zahir Hope, I think mm-hmm. DePaula, I think Sirota, I think Emil Morales, mm-hmm. I think Dalton Rushing, I think Alex Freeland. Again, Freeland I would not say is going to be the centerpiece of a big deal. He could be a part of it.
I'll give you a name that maybe hasn't been ranked super high for us, but feedback from the prospect pad of hitters that faced him in the Midwest League and those that had faced him in the Texas League as well. Patrick Copen is mm-hmm. a name that's like a green arrow up guy and could be sort of the next Dodgers pitcher that wasn't a top round guy that kind of matriculates slowly and then all of a sudden makes this big jump and he's a mid rotation or a number four starter. I think Copen might be a really attractive player to a lot of teams right now as well, because so much of his development is done. Has an unusual story, too. He actually lost an eye last year when he got hit with a comeback.
Yeah, it was brutal.
Has come back, and his stuff is even better, command's even better, which is sort of remarkable. But beyond that, a really good pitcher. And I think like the Dodgers have guys like that and also, you know, hard-throwing relievers that teams love as like a third piece or those complex talents.
We're not kind of
have all that stuff that can fill out that trade. And that's what I think ultimately gets a lot of these deals done at the deadline.
Okay. So now we're going to talk about two prospects for two teams that should be buyers. We'll start by asking the question, if you're the Yankees, are you looking to keep Spencer Jones or could he be the cornerstone maybe in a trade? And we'll cover that right after this quick break. Whenever we need to hire someone at Baseball America, we know who we need. Indeed. When it comes to hiring, Indeed is all you need. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. Indeed sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Why do we use Indeed at Baseball America? Because it gets our position in front of qualified candidates. And it also allows us to do everything we need to make a hire all within Indeed. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts. You only pay for results. How fast is Indeed? In this minute I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed, according to Indeed data worldwide. There's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now. And by doing so, you're supporting our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on our podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring, Indeed, is all you need. Did you know your calendar age doesn't always match how old your body truly is? It's true. Your biological age, the age of your cells and organs, is actually the number one predictor of your risk for serious diseases like heart disease, cancer, dementia, and more. That's why learning your biological age can be truly life-changing, and that's exactly what the True Age Test from True Diagnostic helps you do. With just a simple at-home test, you can uncover your true biological age and get personalized insights into your true biological age and take control of your health like never before. No doctor's visits, no labs, just a quick finger prick from the comfort of your home. I recently ordered the test myself because I really wanted to get a clearer picture of my long-term health. It was eye-opening to learn that if your biological age is just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk for major diseases can go up by 30 to 50%. That's a huge wake-up call for me. But here's the good news, and this is the part that really inspired me. Up to 90% of biological aging is driven by lifestyle. That means the way we eat, move, sleep, and manage stress plays a massive role in how fast or slow our bodies age. True Diagnostic doesn't just tell you your biological age. It gives you a personalized report full of clear, science-backed steps you can take to actually slow down aging and improve your health over time. I'm really excited to see what our results will say and what I can do differently to better support my body as I age. It may be I'm adjusting my sleep. It may be changing supplements. It may be making smarter food choices or exercising more. It feels empowering to know that aging isn't just something that happens. It's something that we have control of. The test itself is super easy. Just a quick, painless finger prick. You send in your sample using a prepaid mailer, and in 2 to 3 weeks, you get a detailed online report with actionable insights that you can use. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code BASEBALL to get 20% off your entire order of subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use BASEBALL at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. So, Jeff, if you're the Yankees, is Spencer Jones, is this time to sell because he's on the greatest heater that we will see this year by any prospect? 10 home runs in, I think, 16 games in AAA, 15 extra base hits. Or is he an untouchable again now because you look at it and say the upside here is just too great to take the risk of dealing him in a move?
I would imagine the only untouchable player in the Yankees system right now is George Lombard. Because I think they can probably headline a pretty decent deal if they were to move Spencer Jones and Cam Schlittler. I think Jones on his face.
They've got a number of arms who could fit like that. Carlos Legrand, hey.
Yeah, but I think when you look at Schlittler, he is major league ready. Jones at this point is probably as major league ready as he's ever been. And, you know, for a team that's not competitive, might be able to give him some of those at bats to make that adjustment that we've kind of seen at every level from Jones, where he struggles, the swing and miss is bad, and he makes a big jump. We haven't seen that in AAA. Some of that's luck, obviously. I mean, you know, there's numbers and things that we could dive into to kind of articulate that a little bit more fully, but the power's there. The angles have been better. I think Ellie, you know, with us has done a great job of kind of illustrating some of the changes and improvements year over year. And he's a guy that's willing to tinker and try different stuff. He's found something that's worked over these last few months. I mean, it's not just the AAA numbers. You know, he was pretty good in AA as well after coming back off injury. So I think the thing with Jones that's supporting all this too is that the tools are pretty good. He's a good outfielder. You're not going to probably play him every day in center field, but certainly has the capability, athleticism, speed to do it. You know, has a good arm, is a good base runner.
Could really be an asset in the corner.
Yeah, really, you know, just the contact is what the big question is. And I still think that's lingering. I don't think that's gone away despite the surface level numbers. And so for that reason, I don't think teams are going to be fooled and like trade away some, you know, huge potential major league piece just strictly for a deal centered around Spencer Jones. But I do think that there's some of these other pieces that they could include, some of the other pitchers as well. Hess Cunningham, who's hurt, but you know, all those guys, LeGrandhe, all those guys are probably pretty attractive to other teams. And you're the Yankees. I think the other part of this too, especially with Jones, it's a really difficult landing space for, you know, young players that are really talented, those that maybe have this sort of fatal flaw. It's almost accentuated in that marketplace and discussed it in even greater detail. So, you know, I think for the Yankees, this is probably a guy you do want to move because it's so hard to hold down an everyday job there and just even be an average regular. Like Anthony Volpe gets a lot of critiques and criticism. I don't think that he gets in Cleveland or Seattle or some of these other markets.
I'll pose it this way. Let's say that Spencer Jones comes up and has a Jack Caglione type start, right? Which, by the way, similar kind of strengths and weaknesses here. You know, Jones is a better athlete. I would say that Jack may have even a little bit more pure power, you know, and has kind of, I would say both Chase, I would say that Jack has generally has had a better ability to make the chase work over the course of his, both of them are young careers, but Jack Caglione has really struggled in his big league debut with the Royals. He was drafted last year, all that, but kind of what your point is that a situation like that in New York may not be treated the same way as it is maybe for, you know, giving a guy a little bit of patience when he's at Kansas City. To go to your point that you said about, you know, there's a little bit of luck involved. We've got him with 18 fly balls, Synergy Sports Stats that, you know, kind of dove into with Synergy. 18 fly balls since he reached AAA. 9 homers among those 18 fly balls. Now, I did look it up just to check, you know, because Aaron Judge, I would say, is kind of the gold standard for fly ball to home run conversion rate in the majors. And Aaron Judge doesn't have a 50% fly ball to home run rate in the big leagues. He's got like 37%, which is really good. But, you know, his chase rate, Spencer Jones' chase rate in AAA hasn't really been much different than it was in AA. The difference is when he's hitting the ball, as you know, as Ellie kind of laid out, he's doing an incredible job of converting anytime he makes contact into incredibly productive contact. But, you know, there is, yeah, like I said, that what the reason I bring it up, you're right. No team is just going to say, we have to have this guy. He's hit 10 homers in 16 games. Everyone knows that he's on a hot streak that no one can sustain. But I do mean, we're sitting here talking about it. We've kind of watched Spencer Jones for years now. You wrote up the many stances of Spencer Jones earlier this season. And we would say, I would say right now, we moved him right back up to number 3 on the Yankees list because you don't ignore it though. This, you know, you don't know if this is how much of this is good fortune, good luck. How much of it is, hey, the ball, you know, they're around the play a little bit more and that kind of plays into his role. Like how much of it is I do think that Spencer Jones does not swing at pitches up and away from him. He's not getting attacked there yet. We'll see. Like maybe they do later on. He wants the ball down. He wants the ball mid and down and in, and you want to stay away from him. We'll see how much they do. All these things are the case, but it'll be fascinating to see. Maybe again, I would say I like what you said. I wouldn't even say that George Lombard's the Yankees. I wouldn't say anyone's untouchable, but you're probably not going to get the deal that you want. Like you're only going to do that if it's like, hey, this is a utterly game-changing trade, and those probably aren't going to happen at the deadline.
I think though, when the Yankees are really good at evaluating their system internally, they always have been. It's definitely a strength. It's something you hear from other organizations when they make trades or they're dealing with the Yankees. So they garner some respect in that area. And I do think that it's clear when they really are fascinated with a particular player. I think we saw that with Volpe. I think we saw it with Jason Dominguez. And those guys get opportunities. And I do think that Lombard very much falls into that category of the things you hear out of their camp, the way that they talk about them. And it's people throughout the organization that it would have to be a massive, massive deal with multiple years of control on a contract for them to deal Lombard.
And The other thing I would say is, I mean, again, we're bringing up this question, but like the Yankees are one of those teams that has such a glaring, clear, we said it with the, there are teams like, we'll get to the Brewers in a little while. The Brewers are tough because I know you said like they can improve their lineup, but their defense is so good. They really, I know that Joey Ortiz hasn't been great at shortstop this year, but they almost across the board, same with the Cubs, like you can't, the Cubs could have bench depth as far as hitting, but there's really no position in their, you know, in their starting nine where you say, oh, if everyone's healthy, there's a glaring hole here. The Yankees, Eugenio Suarez, for example, would look really good as a Yankee and as a rental, even as good as the year as he's having. I think you probably could do that without having to go to, hey, we've got to give multiple elite prospects. He is a couple of month rental. You probably can get away with, okay, we're going to add, you know, we're going to give a pitcher and a lower level position prospect. We'll see. But, you know, that leads us to another team that has a fascinating close to the majors prospect, which is the Phillies, who are in it, and they are as most years. But would you consider, we're not saying trade, I should say, would you consider trading Justin Crawford if that was going to be the difference between making a deal that you really think could help your chances postseason or not? And I say that because Justin Crawford hitting, over 300 in AAA this year, as he usually does, and then at the same time, also kind of showing the thing that was always been true of Justin Crawford, which is how much value is there in an outfielder who is almost, I would not say, let's just say strongly predominantly a ground ball hitter who does not, and when I mean does not pull the ball in the air, especially against fastballs, he has 5 fly balls that he's hit on fastballs this year, and not one has been pulled, according to, again, Synergy Sports Data. He has 16 line drives against fastballs this year. 3 of them have been pulled. And when I say pulled, like line drives that got past the second baseman, line drive up the middle, he has not hit a ball like where he got a hold of it and drove it to the gap, you know, or anything like that. He's a fascinating hitter. But is he someone that you would put in the I don't want to trade him bucket, or is he, you know, and hey, maybe we even bring him up to help the big league club, or does he fit in the, if the deal's right, I would strongly consider it?
Yeah. I guess it depends on how much you like Brandon Marsh and how much you believe that the organization is going to be willing to potentially take on some additional salary this year. Marsh still has 3 years or 2 years after this left to control. He's not a free agent until 2028. Hasn't had a particularly good season. He's been a below average hitter. The numbers haven't been great for his defense in center field either. That said, I think there's still questions regarding, you know, how good Crawford's going to be defensively, particularly in center field. Obviously, there's...
I would say he fits better to replace Kepler if you're going to bring him up.
There you go. So I don't know. I mean, do you think it's a big upgrade from Kepler in the short term? I don't know. I think this is a team that's always sort of chasing championships, big win totals. You know, they're trying to be a contender year in and year out. I don't think that's going to change. Schwarber's off the books this year. I believe JT Realmuto is off the books this year as well. So they might have some flexibility. I honestly think that you do. I don't think this is a player that you feel as if you need to hold because he's somebody that, you know, is going to be a cornerstone for you. I think it could be a good player for you. Or it could be, you know, a slight upgrade from maybe what you have with Brandon Marsh, but there could be a better player that's available on the open market this year, next year, in the offseason, free agency. I don't think this is a cornerstone player that you do not trade. I think if you're the Phillies, this is a player that you've gotten them to this point. It was a good pick a few years ago. Now you can cash in, try to put the team over the top and get that elusive World Series.
I don't disagree with you. I do think that Crawford has a chance that maybe he develops, you know, the way I would describe his setup, his stance is it's very Japanese contact hitter, like the hands way over the head. There's a long way to go from there to get to the zone. And when he does, the bat is almost always kind of at a, you know, it's the bat's the last thing to arrive for him is the way I would describe it. And so with that, you know, you are, he's really good at making contact. He's really good at driving the ball the other way. But if you are going to get impact out of him long-term, he's going to have to make some adjustments. And it's hard to make those adjustments. It's hard to get a guy to make those adjustments when he hits 300 every level, including AAA. This is a guy who kind of, you know, you turn around, he's hitting 315. He's stealing bases everywhere he goes. He's not hitting for a ton of impact. He's not driving the ball. I do think, like, when you say Kepler, he might be an improvement on Kepler. Obviously, there's an adjustment period of the big leagues, but Kepler has been pretty poor for them so far this year and hasn't really been driving the ball either. So you kind of have that where it's like, maybe you take the young guy doing that, who's hopefully getting better. But I would say, like, I'll put it this way. If you're the Phillies and you're talking trade of their top guys, okay, Andrew Painter, I'm still thinking I want to hold on to him and I want to see, can he help the big league club? Eduardo Tait, I'm probably saying there's a chance that this guy could be pretty special. Like, I wouldn't say no chance. I listen. Okay. What the other one is what about Aiden Miller?
Depends on the deal. I think Aiden Miller would be a huge piece to move at the deadline. And, you know, I think the argument can be made that he could be, if he was moved, would be the best player moved. And I don't think I would necessarily straight off the bat say that on Justin Crawford or even on Tait, right? Though there, I think the conversations may be more realistic with Tait as a catcher with some power. And we see how that's trended for years in terms of teams being able to develop ability behind the plate defensively. So, you know, I think that's a different conversation. I think Miller would be a big deal and would have to be a big time player with a couple of years left on the contract and not at crazy money. I think that that's a really valuable trade chip. And I don't know, you know, the trade aggregators and all that sort of thing, how it would play out in real dollars. And I know teams have some version of that, of course, that they consult with. I think Miller would probably be a pretty valuable piece to move. And it would have to be a big time player with multi-years on his deal.
Okay. Moving through some other teams that we think are really interesting. I'll ask you the question, Jeff. So I feel like the Mariners, of all the teams we're talking about, I feel the Mariners are the ones that can be improved the easiest, because when you look at, like, first base, I feel the Mariners are the team that could be improved the easiest at the deadline, because if you look at them and you look at, like, for instance, how bad they've been at first base, when you look at how they could be improved at second or third, when you look at, you know, again, when, as far as they need bats, which is a little easier to find, I'm not going to put them in the Suarez conversation. Maybe it's a reunion, but I feel like that didn't go, you know, probably not. But, like, when you look at first baseman, when you look at Josh Naylor or Ryan O'Hearn or someone like that, those are deals that probably aren't Ryan Mountcastle even. Those aren't probably going to be the break the bank deals. And is that what you would do with the Mariners? And I feel like you could do that with the Mariners and really only dip into what is still a very impressive prospect depth, especially for hitters.
Yeah, and I think you can kind of look at a bunch of positions with them that are easier to fill. DH, first base, second base, as you said. Third might be a little bit harder, but there might be some players out there available, or you can move things around within your infield, or even right field. So they could approach the Orioles and potentially acquire Mountcastle and O'Hearn, because O'Hearn can play a little bit of corner outfield, could DH, could first base, like, they can just swing a deal like that. And, you know, they're not looking for shortstop, center fielders, catchers. I don't think they really need starters, even, like, relievers. We'll see. So that's interesting. Like, they're a team that could go out there and acquire maybe some players. I wouldn't say for pennies on the dollar, but more shopping in the bargain bin of players that, you know, are rentals that go for 80 cents on the dollar in terms of what you can get. And you know, we've seen teams build offenses that have gone deep into the playoffs, making moves like that. The Braves did it and won a World Series, you know, not too long ago. The Diamondbacks made a bunch of acquisitions, smaller ones, guys like Tommy Pham, et cetera, that kind of just lengthened the lineup. And I think that's what the Mariners really need to do, because the top of their order, they got Cal Raleigh having an all-time catcher season, an all-time offensive season. Julio Rodriguez has been down, but I think, you know, a second half surge for him isn't necessarily out of the cards. They add a few pieces around those guys, you know, lengthen that order a little bit, make the middle of the order a little more beefy. They could score a lot more runs, and all of a sudden they're a really dangerous team.
Don't start Donovan Solano, you know, as your primary first baseman in the second half, you know, at post trade deadline, things like that. Like, I mean, those are what we're talking about here. I would, a couple other names I would throw out that kind of fit that, which is like maybe a Willy Castro who doesn't have a primary position for them, but comes in from the Twins to be basically a hitter who can play kind of wherever you need. And maybe even a Ryan McMahon from the Rockies, you know, again, who has a little bit of positional versatility, where we're coming kind of spotlighting guys who these aren't going to be something where you say, hey, Colt Emerson is the ask in return. No, it's not. I don't think Michael Arroyo is the ask in return on these. We're talking smaller deals where you say, yeah, we can do that. We can make that work, you know, and we can do that with kind of guys who are a little bit lower down on their, you know, on their prospect status. But we're kind of rolling through these. But another one that you already brought up a little bit. Okay, Jeff, so if you're the Brewers, as you said, there are some salary limitations here. I would say, but the good news for them is starting rotation, that was supposed to be the question for them coming into the year, but the Brewers are wizards when it comes to the starting rotation. And I feel like right now, barring injury issues, which always could crop up, but feel pretty good if you're the Brewers about, okay, we could take this rotation, especially if we, if you feel comfortable that Mizorowski, you make sure you try to figure out a way to get him through to October. That's a weapon to have as a starting pitcher as well. So what would you do? What would you be looking to do, and how expensive prospect-wise do you think it would be?
Yeah, I don't think they're shopping all that differently from what we were talking about with the Mariners. Andrew Vaughn has been pretty good story. He's been producing for them, was a good get. I think you could add a little depth there just because you have some open spots. I think a corner outfielder is potentially an option. You know, whether that moves Blake Perkins to a bench role or more of a platoon role, I think that's fine. And I also think with some of that depth and some of that defensive ability that you have on this team that you talked about at the top of the show, I think with a team like that, you also kind of naturally have the ability to take on a little bit less defensive value, knowing that you're going to have that player that's maybe strong that you can, you know, use as a late inning defensive replacement, et cetera. It kind of fits the roster correctly. They just need power. I think they need left-handed power. It's a very right-handed heavy lineup. They have a bunch of switch hitters that kind of offset that a little bit. But I think you'd be looking for another left-handed bat that can hit for power, and would just give that lineup a little more depth, a little bit more impact, which is the thing that they're sort of lacking. They can score runs. They manufacture a lot of runs. It's not a bad lineup. It's just more of a middle of the pack lineup. And I think when you get into the playoffs, and we've seen this time and time again, those teams that manufacture runs have a little harder time scoring runs once you get against the best pitchers with good defenses behind them, with good bullpens. You need to be able to change the game with one swing, work deep into counts, get on base, and sort of, you know, grind out at bats like that. And they're not that kind of team. I think that that poses a challenge when it comes to winning ball games in the playoffs. This is going to be a playoff team. It's just a matter of, is this the kind of team that's constructed to win games in the division round, the championship series, or get to that World Series? You know, if you're a Brewers fan, that's what you want. And I think that they have a deep enough system, a proven program of identifying, acquiring talent, getting the most out of those guys, that they can keep on rolling with this and not trade away the Peñas, the Mades, Mizorowski still a prospect, or Pratt. They still have some of those pieces that could really move the needle. And there might even be players like a Bishop Letson or whoever who other teams might value more than how they're ranked on a top 100 list, that they might be in that conversation for some of these organizations, depending upon traits, their scouts, preferences, all that sort of stuff. We have to keep that in mind. This is a deep system.
Logan Henderson is another example of a guy who, again, if I'm the Brewers, I'm not just giving him away by any stretch because he's started and been successful for them at the major league level this year. But having guys like that, a Robert Gasser, who we kind of can forget about, but is a guy who, if I'm a team who's rebuilding and says cost-controlled starting pitcher, there are a number of these guys where they have kind of the pieces to make some swings here, I would say. And yeah, they're in a good situation for that.
And I feel like they have some lower level guys that are interesting. They have those mid-tier double A type guys. And even some major league pieces, as you mentioned. I think another name I'll call out is Aaron Ashby has shown great stuff. And I think is the type of arm that, health permitting, another organization might see him as, we can convert this guy to a starter and maybe we'll start in drips and drabs that is 3 or 4 inning chunks. And then we can eventually expand it out to 5 innings or so, and the stuff is really good. And, you know, all of this might play. He's got a deep pitch arsenal. You know, we've seen a lot of these reliever to starter conversions after guys kind of get their beaks wet in the big leagues. And Ashby's been pretty good.
Ashby's another example of that. You could, you know, again, you've got the guys like, if someone calls about Luke Adams, I'm listening because he's a very interesting profile. I don't know, you know,
models love him.
And they should. But again, part of it is how much is walks and hit by pitches going to carry over to the big league level? We'll see, you know, but again, like Craig Yoho as a throw in, not a throw in, but as a second or third piece in a trade where you're like optionable reliever who has some upside here as a reliever who could pitch not the fifth, but the sixth or the seventh, and maybe even the eighth in the situation. A lot of interesting options there. Another team that, again, their system, the emergence of player after player kind of gives them options.
Yeah, I mean, I even look at a name like Chad Patrick, who's had a pretty good season for them and is in AAA because they just have too many starters. Like, that might be a really attractive piece to a team where it's like, we've already seen this guy be good in the big leagues and have all the data we possibly could have to, you know, evaluate this guy, et cetera. So I think there's a few like that. It's an interesting system.
How much of a concern, though, if I'm a team, it depends on who I am as a team, right? But if I'm a team and if I'm a GM and I'm self-analyzing, I say, our pitching development, our pitching, getting the most out of our pitchers is something we struggle with. I also have a little bit of concern of trading for some of these Brewers pitchers because, you know, they're really good at this. So there's always a chance for some regression, not because Chad Patrick isn't very good with them, but can you get the same out of Chad Patrick as they do, I would say, or with a Logan Henderson or with a Robert Gatt, you know, because we're talking about guys, Tobias Myers, these guys where it's like, these were often kind of free talent for them when they find them. Mm-hmm. They're guys who weren't costing a whole lot when they added them. And then they, again, this is what the hallmark of a great organization, or ones who turn that into real value because they get the best out of those players. And then you can sometimes turn around after you've gotten the player a lot better and say, okay, now we can trade them. But
yeah, it goes both ways, though. Sometimes, you know, those trades work out for the team that acquires the guy after the breakout, and other times it doesn't. You know, it's like Rich Hill when he came back with the Red Sox from Indy Ball and they let him walk and, you know, goes to Oakland and then is really good. And Rich Hill's making starts still to this day in the big leagues. But so you never know. You know, Charlie Morton, I think, you know, coming off of, was it with the Phillies where he kind of broke out, then got hurt, and then was it Tampa, then Houston, or Houston and Tampa? I have to look. But
and then Braves for a while. And
yeah, again, but like, but that breakout happened before, mm-hmm. you know, it was when right before the injuries, really when the breakout happened, and then another team jumped on it. So, you know, I don't think it's a bad idea. There's a lot of choose your own adventures within the Brewer system for sort of any taste or flavor. They're like a Cheesecake Factory menu.
Okay. So then we've talked about the Yankees a little bit, but let's kind of take it a little broader because the AL East is still a division where, okay, the Orioles, will put them to the side. They're sellers. They've even kind of started selling and come out and said that they're most likely sellers. Everyone else, could be a buyer. I would say that the Rays and the Yankees may not be always shopping at the same, you know, if the Rays may be shopping more at kind of the bargain bin. They're hitting the Walmart, you know, and kind of looking for good deals as they always do. But they are a team that is in it and could be looking to improve. They always make trades at the deadline. Whatever the Rays are doing, you can feel comfortable that they're going to be busy at the deadline, whether they're buyers, sellers, or both. How do you see, like, it does feel like that you could also see situations where some of these teams end up bidding against each other to try to help their teams.
I think that's kind of where we're at. And the Blue Jays have very much entered the fray. And for the first time in a while, they have a pretty good farm system. You know, the top of the farm has looked better than it's looked in a while. There's some position players there now, though obviously JoJo Parker's not getting traded. I don't think Namala is either. There's a lot of pitching in that system. There were reports today that they're in on Mitch Keller and could swing a trade like that. They've been an aggressive front office. They've also been a front office that struggled a little bit to close the big deals, the Sotos, the Otanis, Roki Sasaki when he came over.
The big free agent deal.
Yeah, they've been in the midst of all those, but, you know, haven't necessarily been able to allocate that money. They made some signings this offseason in Santander. Of course, they made the trade for Jimenez. It wouldn't shock me if, you know, they tried to swing a bigger deal and potentially were talking extension with whoever they acquired afterward as well, just kind of knowing what their off seasons have been like the last couple of years. And their willingness to spend money and invest in this team long term, of course, with the Vlad Guerrero Jr. extension. So I think you look at this team, and they're a big X factor because they haven't been that team over the last, you know, year or so. But we know what this front office operates like. The Yankees are at a point where they made the World Series last year. You know, I think it's World Series championship or bust for them. They invested a lot of money into this team. There are some glaring holes, as you mentioned. I think some easy sort of fixes with a Suarez or whoever at third base. The Red Sox are really interesting and can kind of go a little bit of both ways. I don't anticipate them to be big buyers in the sense that they're willing to swing the biggest of trades, or we see another Crochet type of blockbuster, but could be in on some pieces, could also make trades for players with, you know, longer term deals where they're switching out areas of strength for a player who's an area of weakness. I don't think that would be outrageous to see them do something like that as well. And then, as you mentioned, the Rays, they're funny because they can swing these long-term deals, or they can do something where maybe they trade away, you know, a lesser player for somebody who's on an expiring deal and the contract is prorated, so they don't have to take on that much money. And it's just this rental sort of player. When they went after like Nelson Cruz a few years ago, if I'm not mistaken, that was kind of along those lines.
They wish they could have that one over again. That was Joe Ryan for Nelson Cruz.
That was a bad one, but they're willing to make deals like that. And I think we're in a competitive space where enough teams make the playoffs and winning the division is in theory an advantage, though it hasn't always played out like that in the playoffs. I think getting that rest, setting your rotation still has value. And I think it's wide open. There's still three or four teams that if they make a good run, we've seen it. The Blue Jays have been hot, particularly at home. I think they've won 11 in a row. Coming into the break, though, they've lost a few series now. The Red Sox were 10-0 coming into the break. We've seen them make a run. The Rays have been hot at points in time. The Yankees have kind of been steady, consistent. So we'll sort of see how this division plays out, but I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that any of these four teams could end up on top, you know, when the regular season bell finally rings, and all of them are going to be probably looking to buy and in a contention window right now. So I think it's really interesting because it harkens back to kind of the old AL East where, you know, we had some of the big giants with the money to spend, particularly the Red Sox, the Yankees, and now the Blue Jays, who I do think are a big market team. Willing to go out there and spend some of their prospect capital to reinforce their squads.
We have another trade proposal along those lines since we are talking about the Rays. Patrick Ellington has a trade proposal here. Guardians Rays trade. And he says, Emmanuel Clase, and the Guardians get Carson Williams, Yaniel Correa, and Gary Gilhill, which again, I will give credit on this trade. I like trades where you're like, if your initial reaction on a big deal is like, ooh, I've got to analyze this from both sides, then you've started well. Now, I'm going to start by saying, I don't feel this is the type of trade that the Rays usually do. If the Rays are going to go get bullpen help, I feel like it's more often they do kind of the Peter Fairbanks for Nick Solak, and Peter Fairbanks is in the minors, and then 2 weeks later, he's pitching key games for them in the majors kind of deal, where they're like, here's a guy we've identified, and we think that, you know, this guy, we can do this with him, kind of the deal that they've also already done with the Orioles here. Those kind of moves more than, hey, we're going to add a closer, an elite closer, but a closer who kind of carries with it the prospect value. But from that standpoint, if that trade happened, let's just pose it this way, Jeff. If that trade happened, who's winning that trade?
I think the Guardians win that trade. You know, it's a closer, and I just feel like their shelf life is small. And small things, injuries, tweaks, can change a lot, where a guy goes from the best closer in baseball or a top five closer in baseball, shut down stopper, to a guy who's a good closer, you know, to almost losing his job and is a good reliever. You know, we've seen it with Kimbrel, we've seen it with Papelbon and so many of these guys. I think the other thing too is some of his success is beyond the swing and miss stuff, but kind of controlling contact, which I think at times can be a little bit voodoo, and that can go away quickly, and all of a sudden you're giving up a lot of bad contact. I think these are a lot of players to trade. Even if they all come with some question marks attached, I think they're all big leaguers, and, you know, potentially some average regulars are better. So I think that's a lot of value, a lot of years of control to give up if you're the Rays. And yeah, I just think it would be uncharacteristic, though. You know, for a more aggressive front office, it's not out of the realm of possibility something like this could go down.
I would say it this way. I don't think of many trades. You said they will do rentals, they will do things like that. One thing that the Rays do not do, though, that trade right there, Carson Williams has less value at this moment right now than he did coming into the year, because he's been running up well north of 30% strikeout rate all year, gotten better lately, but is still struggling in AAA. Gary Gilhill has kind of taken a step back from last year. I would say that the Rays more usually are always kind of, I would say, in the arbitrage. You know, they're always looking and saying, who's the player whose value we believe perceive as higher than the industry? And who do we have whose value in the industry is higher than we perceive it to be? Again, I feel like they're more likely to make those moves where you go, huh, okay, let me piece that together. And sometimes they win, sometimes they lose them. But it's more, I would say that they're more likely to be the team that adds two relievers who, when you hear their names, you're like, who or why did they get him? And then you dig deeper and it's like, oh, they brought this guy in and they completely shelved this pitch and they emphasized this pitch. And all of a sudden he's one of their better relievers kind of thing. That's the approaches I feel like that they do. But that also segues us nicely into another question. Let's talk about a couple of sellers or teams that we perceive as potentially sellers. Okay, maybe the Guardians don't swing a Emmanuel Class A trade with the Rays, but if you were running the Guardians, is this a where they sit right now? And just kind of laying it out, they are right around 500. Right, they're not going to catch the Tigers. We can feel comfortable about that. Are they buyers? Are they sellers? Do you kind of regroup for next year, or, you know, say we just don't have the horses here to be a team? We might be able to sneak our way into the playoffs if everything breaks right, but we're not going to do anything there. So let's reassess. Or what do you do?
Yeah. I think when you're an organization like this, where there's, you know, obviously always going to be some financial constraints in terms of, you know, the players that you have access to and you know, the types of acquisitions that you can make, I think you got to have a lot of conversations. And what do I mean by that? I mean that you got to kind of talk out of both sides of your mouth. You probably have to have the conversations around buying just to see what's available. And, you know, if you can put your team over the top and get into that wild card mix, especially if there's some years attached to a contract and, you know, you have players that the other team values. I also think that you need to have some seller conversations, but probably more regarding short-term type of players. I don't think selling Class A would be the worst idea in the world. He's got another year of control after this. The dollars are really good. Potentially he's a player that you can move and get back some pieces that, you know, you can reinforce with, or, you know, strengthen up the system. If you're a buyer next year, I think you can always think like that. I think maybe Carlos Santana, if there's another bullpen piece or a lower level prospect that you want to take a chance on that your scouts like, I think he's a guy that you could potentially move. There's probably, you know, you're not, Shane Bieber does make a rehab start today with Lake County. So he could be back in the picture. I don't know if you want to necessarily trade him at this moment, but I guess that's a possibility, but just kind of what is the return going to be? He does have an option year next year. It is a player option though, for $16 million. So I would assume he might, if he pitches well, opt out of that. But maybe as an extension candidate and a team feels that they could buy low and the Guardians say, hey, this guy's not going to take the option. So why not try to make a deal? But a lot of that is going to come down to what he looks like in the next couple of weeks. And I don't know if that's enough time to really make a good evaluation. I don't know if the Guardians necessarily have this big shiny piece, you know, like another team does that we'll talk about. I think the Braves in a minute with like an Ozuna or somebody where it's like, yeah, he's out of contract and a team could take him and we're happy to take back whatever we can get. It's probably Carlos Santana, but I don't know how excited you are to acquire Carlos Santana. He's kind of a last option sort of target.
The thing that's tough with them is, other than their two, what I would say, star players, which are Stephen Kwan and Jose Ramirez, as far as position players, you said you trade Santana in a minute and a half and you're fine. And you bring up CJ Cephas and you say, okay, we think that we have a chance to be just as good for the rest of the year. And you've saved some payroll and all that. But they have a lot of players who are kind of or at least have produced at a level, kind of a meh level, you know, MEH kind of level where you're like, you could do better. But at the same time, they're not going to have a ton of value in trade. So, and they're in a lot of cases, they're not like expensive. They're not in arbitration. So maybe you give them longer runway. I don't know. Like they're a tough team that way from the standpoint of just looking at them and saying, I don't know if you, other than if you said, we're going to really be aggressive on this and trade pitching and for, like, I don't think this is the team that you're feeling like is a complete teardown. And if it's not, it does feel like you may get kind of stuck in the middle again next year. We'll see. I mean, they have some interesting prospects, but at the same time, I would also say with that, while they have, I would describe it as they have interesting prospects. I would not say that they have a whole lot of guys where you're like, okay, you know, Bazan has been hurt. That has not helped. Hopefully he is their second baseman starting next year. They have guys like Janal, they have guys, Jason Churio still has bat to ball skills, has not hit the ball, you know, hard at all. CJ Cephas is very interesting, but at the same time is kind of a first base corner outfield profile. They have a lot of like, but kind of guys. So I don't know. This one's a tough one. I think this next one that you just already kind of foreshadowed is maybe even tougher, which is, what about if you're running the Braves? Now, they are sellers. This is the first year in a very long time that Atlanta is at this point in the year and you say, abandon hope. And some of that is injury-based. Chris Sale, very important to them, missing. Again, if Chris Sale had gone down with an arm injury, I would say that you could say with that, you knew you were running some risk. A rib injury, I would say, is, you know, a little different. And then Spencer Schwellenbach, who has been as good a pitcher for them as almost anyone, also going down didn't help. And, you know, we could kind of, there've been a lot of injuries on the pitching side, but on the hitting side, this has been the most static lineup that there's out there because they had their catcher and their first baseman and their second baseman and the third baseman and their center fielder and their right fielder all signed to long-term deals. The center fielder, Michael Harris, has really had a massive regression this year. He's still quite young, but has been very lost at the plate, still good defensively. And Ozzie Albies, who is still at an age where you would not say, oh, old age is coming for Ozzie Albies. But Ozzie Albies, who has battled injuries in recent years, is also looking quite lost at the plate a lot of the time, or really not just the same kind of hitter as he's been. Is this time to just trade away the veterans who are kind of at the tail end of contracts? Or is this a time for the Braves in your mind to do bigger, to think bigger?
You know, I think ideally the best thing they could do is probably they have some good contracts on good players that, you know, maybe could be replaced or upgraded, over time, especially in free agency. I think that Sean Murphy is a very movable player for them right now. He's a very good defensive catcher. He carries his weight with the bat as well. I think, you know, at the deadline for a competitive team that wants to upgrade behind the plate or strengthen their catching platoon, Murphy is super attractive because he can DH as well, you know, when needed, or maybe the other player moves to DH. That, you know, he's the type of player with a couple of years left in that contract at good dollars. I could see a team, you know, making a pretty substantial offer on a player like Murphy. You know, I also...
Can I throw one out for that?
Sure.
What about the Padres?
I think the Padres would be like a perfect fit and have some interesting players. And we know that they're willing to be aggressive when it comes to trading away some of their good prospects.
I feel we can comfortably say that you can always say with the Padres that the Padres are not going to be scared to make moves. But yeah. I say this, I bring this up because, you know, the Padres have Martin Maldonado, who I know this is going to shock people, but has not hit this year. You know, Elias Diaz, they've got some veteran catchers. You know, I think Luis Campusano has been up a little
good
bit.
Secondary guys.
But Sean Murphy would massively improve them at catcher. And by the way, for all the pitching that the Braves draft and how much they've kind of focused on pitching and draft and development in recent years, the Drake Baldwin drafting him, developing him, and seeing him emerge like he has this year is one positive development for the big league team in a year that hasn't had a whole lot of positive developments. I don't know still if it makes up, again, in the sliding doors of the world, I don't know if Contreras, if they don't trade Contreras, if Contreras is as good for them as he is for the Brewers, just because the Brewers are as good as there is out there as far as improving catchers, but maybe he is. Maybe that's one that they would like to have, you know, over again. But Baldwin gives them a young, inexpensive catcher who kind of has been matching what they get from Murphy. So that does make a whole lot of sense. Okay, I will also ask this, though. Do you trade Ozzie Albies?
That was where I was going to go next. I jokingly kind of had posed an Acuna trade in the chat just because I'd love to see a big player traded, but that's not going to obviously happen.
Yeah, I think you'd be stupid to do that.
Yeah, Austin Riley's not getting traded. They're not going to trade Strider. I don't think, you know, at this point you're not trading Michael Harris, and I think you got to ride that one out and see where it goes. But I think Albies at this point, with the dollars, despite the lack of production, I think he's still probably kind of an attractive, I wouldn't call it a reclamation project, though it is in some ways, that a team might be willing to take that on and say, hey, look, it's still a really good contract and he's better than what we have. And maybe there's X, Y, and Z we feel we can fix with him and kind of get him back to a level that, you know, he's used to performing at. So as you said, he's still very young. He's like 28, going to be 29 next year. So I think that, you know, the door's not closed on him having three or four more really productive seasons. So I think he is maybe an attractive piece, maybe not as attractive as Murphy, because the performance hasn't been as good and there isn't that sort of elite defensive value right off the bat at a premium position like you get with Murphy. But I still think could swing them back some good players. And I think the lack of depth in that system has caught up to them in some ways, that they haven't had those plug and play pieces or upside players that they can call up from the minors. A lot of it has been veteran reclamation projects like an Orlando Arcia or whoever, though not Alvarez is playing for them right now. But I just think the high end position talent hasn't been there. Maybe being able to acquire some of that could be helpful.
I would put it this way, like with Michael Harris, in an ideal world, and this is showing my age, there was a time with Ron Gant, who was a very promising young hitter in the Braves organization, came up to the big leagues and then was playing second base at the time and was not a good second baseman and then really was lost at the plate. They sent him all the way back to the complex to learn to play the outfield, but they were able to kind of also use that as a reset at the plate. The Braves haven't really had a chance to kind of do a reset with Michael Harris at the plate. Even again, I'm not saying you would send him down, but it's not really much of an option because he's good enough defensively. There's no scenario where you could say they don't have someone sitting at AAA where you're like, that guy's bad. That guy with Harris's struggles could at least be as good while we try to fix Harris. They haven't had those plan Bs at a lot of these positions. The other thing I'll say about Albies, it is a bad year. 2 years of team option, $7 million a year with a $4 million buyout, I believe. That's still quite inexpensive for the next 2 years, where it's kind of worth it to maybe take a chance on if you're in our team. But the other thing I'll say with that is there aren't many middle infielders who are available. When we ran through like this, like there are third basemen we just talked about. There are utility players like Willie Castro who you can put him at shortstop. You don't want to play shortstop regularly. You don't want to really want to play him at second regularly probably at this point. There's guys like that. But if you said, hey, we need a shortstop. Hey, we need a second baseman who's going to give you good defense at second base and all that. Not a whole lot of options that look like they'll be available at the deadline. That could feed into it as well. And I say that because the flip side of that is, yeah, I mean, Marcell Ozuna makes a whole lot of sense to trade. I will say, go back and look. And yes, you just brought up Nelson Cruz for Joe Ryan is the example of a DH at the deadline landing a premium dude. Because Joe Ryan, there was questions about how well his fastball at the top of the zone with tons of carry would play in the majors. He hadn't shown in the majors yet, but that was a premium prospect. But then go look at what the JD Martinez trade was when the Tigers traded the D-backs. And it was like Dawel Lugo and Sergio Alcantara and Jose King, I think. You're not going to get a ton from Marcell Ozuna, even if he's fully healthy, and he's not been fully healthy right now. That's going to be a probably less than you expect trade. And I'll say, yeah, if you're a Braves fan, if you want to be upset about that, just remember what you traded to bring in Jorge Soler and the entire new outfield the year you won the World Series. Right. You didn't give anything up because those players on rentals don't bring back a lot in trade value.
Agree 100%.
So any other team we haven't covered that you want to hit, you know, before we move on?
No, I think we've covered all the important teams to sort of run through from the seller and buyer perspective.
There are some others that we could get to, like, you know, we haven't talked about the Twins. We haven't talked about like out of the Royals buyers and stuff, but again, we can't cover everyone. We're sorry. And before we leave, we do, as we always want to, we want to get to our prospect soapboxes, which we always talk about that this is non-top 100 prospects who we find interesting for some sort of reason. And Jeff, we haven't added draftees to our top 100 yet. That's coming soon. But that said, even when we do, this player will not be joining the 100. So he fully fits within the prospect soapbox idea. So who is your soapbox this week?
We're going to talk about newly drafted Cleveland Guardians outfielder Jaceslav Ouellette. I think this is maybe there's a lot of them because of the way this draft kind of worked out, but he's maybe the most fascinating player to me in this class. Had, I guess, a down year by his standards, only had a 1,000 OPS, hit 258, which is a terrible batting average in college baseball. But, you know, over the course of three seasons at Texas A&M in the SEC, the best baseball conference in the world for college baseball, does have a near 1100 OPS. We know he dealt with some injuries this year, some struggles at the beginning of the season, was really good for points of the year. I think when you look at the underlying data, there are some swing and miss issues. I don't think that they are swing and miss issues that make him, that eliminate him from being a good professional player. There's on-base skills, there's power, there's good angles. There was athleticism, and what we've heard that ticked back a little bit. It's a weird year, and I just kind of want to see how the reset happens here. We know he's not going to play at all. I believe it was due to a hand injury, you know, following the draft, so we won't see him until next spring. That is a good chunk of time for him to work on the things that he needs to work on, improve physically, you know, get back to health. I find him to be so fascinating because this was a guy that was legitimately in best player in the draft conversations, 1-1 conversations about 6 months ago. And I just wonder how much some of the other elements that we can't fully grasp and measure impacted him and impacted his season. And if this could be a really big win for the Guardians, because they don't have a player like this that has the power on base skills and defensive value in the system like this guy does. They have a lot of contact hitters that have defensive value. Not a lot of guys that could, you could say pretty reasonably could hit 30 home runs and offer some other upside as well. So I just wanted to take this time post-draft to talk about a player that I'm really interested now that he's in pro ball as to where this goes next year. Quite a ways away from answering these questions. But I do think it's interesting to see if, you know, maybe the Guardians can get to enough contact that, you know, he's a really well-rounded offensive player with some defensive skills, you know, that long-term could maybe even blossom into a star, like I think a lot of people thought. So Jace Lavallette is my prospect soapbox because I still have some positivity around this player. And I feel like he's just very divisive.
Okay. Two things with that. One, I do find it fascinating that the Guardians are kind of, this is the anti-Guardians player in a lot of ways, but maybe, like you said, maybe it's like, hey, instead of us finding all the guys with the bat-to-ball skills, maybe we'll add the guy who needs to add the bat-to-ball skills, and maybe we can develop that, and he already has power that we don't have a whole lot of guys who have. To pose a question to you, you said like that maybe, you know, like his batting average was way too low this year. There are concerns about, again, the hitting ability. I bring up the worst case scenario, I would say, for him that we're seeing right now is Vance Honeycutt was a more athletic player than Jace Lavallette. But at this time last year with Vance Honeycutt, we were talking about this is a guy who has power, who has speed, who can play center field. And the real concern, you know, he had an 1100 OPS. Now, it was in the ACC, not the SEC. Mm-hmm. But again, that says top level. And he'd done that, you know, he'd had 1,000 OPS twice in 3 years at North Carolina. Vance Honeycutt goes to pro ball this year with the Orioles and has a strikeout rate that we were talking about Spencer Jones earlier. Vance Honeycutt looks at Spencer Jones' strikeout rate and says, if I can get it to that next year, that would be a significant improvement. It's been over 40%. You know, it's been really, really, you know, concerning. He is... The power has disappeared because of that. He is stealing bases, but they're very different. I don't want to make it sound like, but like, what do you see in Lavallette that you said, like, that makes you feel like when you talk about those kind of concerns about the hit tool, what makes you feel a level of comfort that maybe those are not the same level of severity as maybe Honeycutt was last year?
I think when you look at pitch by pitch performance and then dig into actual whiff rates, zone whiff rates, et cetera, it's below average. It's not like 30 grade poor the way we saw with Honeycutt. And he is facing better pitching in the SEC than what Honeycutt was seeing in the ACC. There's some debate as to what that is, and you could go pitcher by pitcher. I still think that all of the ingredients are there in a bigger way. The contact's better. The approach is better. Now, Honeycutt walked a lot. Honeycutt was like overly passive, where Laviolette's like zone swing rates and his aggressiveness is just more on par with what you want to see from good approach for those guys that are a little bit passive versus Honeycutt, who was super, super passive and still was like whiffing in zone at incredibly high rates. I think there's still similar concerns. I just think Jace is a better, more explosive hitter. The angles are better. The power is better. You know, maybe not the athlete or defender that Honeycutt is. But I do think that, you know, he's proven, you know, particularly his sophomore year, that he's just can reach a higher level than Honeycutt ever hit.
I would say LaViolette, tried to watch a lot of his swings this year. I'm not making myself out to be a hitting guru. I did talk to some people about Jace also. There are things I think that can be cleaned up. There are things in his setup. There are things in how he starts his swing and all where I would say that if you said that Jace LaViolette is exactly the guy we saw this year, I do not think that that guy can be a big league, successful big league hitter. I do think though that that is a step on the journey. And I do think a year like the year he had this year, we talked about this with Justin Crawford. When you have the point where you're like, okay, this isn't working, you're much more open to saying, well, what will work? This is causing me problems. What can I do now? Whereas again, and I'm not saying about but in Justin Crawford's case, it's like this, we don't think this is going to work for you long-term. It's hard to say I'm going to rework things pretty significantly when I'm basically battling for a batting crown in every league I ever play in. That's tougher to do, to say, maybe this will work, maybe it won't. All of a sudden I'll be hitting 240 and you'll say, oops, we're sorry. The power hasn't come and now you're not nearly as good a hitter. In Jace LaViolette's case, this year has been a little bit of a setback. You can't complain about his willingness to do things. He went back out there with a broken hand and was, or, you know, finger, and be like, I'm good. I'm going to keep playing because I want to help my team. With all that, you know, again, it's going to be interesting to see. But that gets me to my prospect soapbox, guy who is the flip side, is having an excellent year this year. We went back and looked. I don't think I've done him. It wouldn't shock me if I was the first guy I did. But the Orioles have had a couple of guys at the lower levels really emerge. I think maybe I did an Esteban Mejia one of these times. But Nate George, who was in rookie ball in the complex league, now in low A. If you haven't paid it, I'm getting him out there because now we are going to add draftees, which is going to make it tougher. But this is a guy, when we talked early in this podcast a while ago now about how guys on the cusp of the 100, Nate George is a cusp of the 100 guy now. He came into the year, he couldn't see the 100. It was over the horizon from where he was. But you look at what he's done this year. If he gets to the bat at bats, which he should over the second half of the year, this guy who could compete for the minor league batting title this year, you know, he got a late start to that, obviously, because he was in rookie ball, which gets to a later start. But he is hitting so far this year, 354, 412, 531. He plays like his hair is on fire. He is at least a 70. You can get 8 run times. He's a threat on the bases. He collects triples, you know, like very few players can. There is some gap power there. He's a good defender in center field. This is a guy who I think is a credit to the Orioles got him in the 16th round out of Illinois last year, high school player in Illinois. And here we are. He has greatly exceeded. If you redrafted right now that 2024 draft, he's going in the top 2-3 rounds. I would put it that way. He's probably going in the top. He might go in the first. I'm putting it that way. He's been that impressive. The way to just summarize this, you know, we're talking about the Orioles right now, Vance Honeycutt versus Nate George, both of them are center fielders. You're taking Nate George 10 out of 10 times. Honeycutt was a premium pick last year. George was a 16th rounder, but Honeycutt struggling in A ball and George is tearing the cover off of it in A ball and is also much younger and is faster. Doesn't have maybe the same power, but is also a center fielder, you know, who can defend in center. There's a lot of things here that just stand out with Nate George. He's a name to definitely watch if you haven't been paying attention yet to Nate George. He moved up again on our Orioles list in our latest top 30 update. We'll be doing another one of those updates after the trade deadline. So we will, you know, we'll see, you know, how far further he keeps climbing, but he's another interesting to watch. this was a good, you know, again, this was a good one. We're trying to make up for the fact we missed last week. We gave you effectively two for the price of one this week on the podcast. But Jeff, you know, what else are you looking forward to this week? I will say that I'm looking forward to, as we record this, Mizorowski's going tonight. So I'll be watching that.
Apparently not watching Vance Honeycutt because he's caught lots of strays on this podcast.
Sorry, Vance. It's nothing personal against the player, but it is something where, like, yeah, we rank Nate George higher on the Orioles list now than we do Honeycutt. So yes,
we're slowing down the UNC to Baseball America pipeline. One comment at a time here. We'll say something positive about Belichick next week, I promise. But I'm looking forward.
That will not come out of my lips. I'll just tell you.
It will come out of my lips, though. We're gonna keep rolling. You know. Over here in the command center, now that I'm home watching minor league games, we got a bunch of good starters coming up tonight. You know, kind of from early evening right on through until 10 o'clock, we got Gage Staniford going. So excited, going to dig into some games, maybe watch about six tonight. So that's what I got going on.
I will say for me, looking ahead, I believe on Saturday, I'm going to go to Durham and see Robbie Snelling versus Forrest Whitley, which not the same cachet as it would have had, you know, at different times, like, you know,
the
like
old and the new.
Yeah. The old and the new, you know, but that should be fun. And also catch up with one of those, baseball friends I have, who I've never met in person, but we'll finally get to meet in person after talking to in, you know, for years, you know, so yeah, one of those. So I'll look forward to that on Saturday as well. We hope you enjoyed this Baseball America podcast. Please like and subscribe. Click the bell if you're on YouTube. If you have ideas, if you have comments, feel free to leave them on the YouTube channel because we do try to read them. We do try to respond. Can't respond to all of them, but I do try to read as many and respond to as many as I can, even though we do get a good number of them now. Thank you for that, everyone. We will be back next week with probably, you know, again, we by this time next week, I think we've probably seen a couple of deals, right? I would hope.
Think so.
So for Jeff, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.